New numbers keep coming in the COVID-19 pandemic. The coronavirus has now killed more than 75,000 people in the United States and infected well over 1.2 million people. And millions more American jobs have been destroyed.
What we have seen is the fastest layoffs ever in history, the fastest economic contraction ever in history. It's like the world woke up and it was a completely different place.
Well, let's start with the basic number, the 14.5% unemployment rate. That's obviously a staggering number. It just tells us that there's an enormous amount of pain out there. Unfortunately, there's actually more pain than is indicated by that number. As you know, Rick, those numbers are collected about the 12th of the month. So since the 12th of the month, there have been a number of unemployed workers that have come in through the initial claims. We've seen that. So right now, we probably have about 40 million workers unemployed, which maps into an unemployment rate that's Great Depression level.
This is a very, very grim picture, and it only partially captures the real pain and suffering that is out there. And you need only go out to food banks to see it play out every single day. I think, John, in terms of the analytics of what we saw, as bad as the numbers are, and they are very bad and historic, as you have been saying this morning, they actually understate how bad the situation is. They lag. As Mike pointed out, if you go to the U6, the more comprehensive picture of unemployment, it is much worse in terms of levels and change than the one that's reported widely. If you look at who's getting hit the hardest, it is the people that can least afford it.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Unemployment claims came in at a lower level this week. 3.2 million workers filed for unemployment. The unemployment rate rises to 14.7%. That's the highest level we've seen since the Great Depression. However, there's some good news. Experts believe the April numbers will be the worst of the shutdown as more and more states are now opening up for business. Well, the market seemed to like this news with a strong rally on Friday. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me today will be Dave Keller. He's chief market strategist at StockCharts. Dave sees this still as a bear market rally, with mega cap stocks, technology, and healthcare leading this market. Also, Greg Weldon joins me later as we take a deep dive into the economic numbers, the problem with oil, and one particular oil investment you want to avoid, as well as this country's mounting debt problems, which is a story I've written about this week, which we feature on our website. And in this week's Big Picture, Chris Sheridan and I will look at our topic, Recession, Depression, and the Long Road to Serfdom. But first, let's go to Ryan Poplava and find out what moved the markets this week.
Thanks, Jim. The U.S. stock market got off to a bad start on Monday as White House officials carried the baton over the weekend, speaking out against China's handling of COVID-19. But the worst news of all over the weekend was the admission by Warren Buffett that Berkshire Hathaway had finished dumping all of its airline company holdings. It's interesting because I can remember stories of Warren as recently as March purchasing more and additional shares of Delta. So I think the news from a long-term investor like Warren, and just given the dismal outlook that companies have been reviewing over the earnings season, shows that it could be years before the airline industry recovers its former demand, as consumer habits and businesses all are likely to change their travel behavior in the wake of the widespread pandemic. United Airlines CEO Oscar Munoz has said recently that he does not expect the return demand to a healthy pace until 2021. And at the end of 2019, Buffett had owned almost 59 million shares of Delta, 51 million shares of Southwest, 42.5 million shares of American Airlines, and almost 22 million shares of United. So he was very well invested in the industry, now all divested into other areas. Despite the terrible news, most averages were able to turn a positive on Monday morning, and the transports were actually able to turn positive for the week by Friday, up 2.3%. Throughout the rest of the week, rallies in the morning would carry stocks to their highs on reopen sentiment, that businesses would reopen and that we would continue to see a reopening of the economy, but then would fade in the afternoon, running up against technical resistance or valuation concerns, something we've been talking about here on the show. Many large cap stocks fared well throughout this period this week. Stocks were largely dismissing dismal economic news in weeks past with the opinion that conditions will improve in the weeks and months ahead. Unemployment claims continue to show and reinforce that opinion as the increase each week has been less than the week prior. This week's news was no different, with a decrease of around 677,000 from last week's report. We have essentially seen the peak in jobless claims. Now, it keeps going up. Every week, we have more jobless claims being announced, but that number continues to fall each week. The issue, however, is that these jobs probably won't recover as fast as they were lost. Another report that conditions are improving came from Uber, which said it has seen week-on-week growth over the past 3 weeks. There was another story, Walt Disney's Shanghai will be opening up soon, and they opened up ticket sales, which sold out within minutes. Boeing recently said it will start its 737 MAX production again later in May. And California finally joined the fold and announced its reopening parts of retail on Friday and will continue to have phases like many other states have. Let's talk about the final news item this week, which was April's non-farm payrolls. The headline number was bad, but I'd like to dig into some of the details to reveal more of the current conditions. Let's start with a decline of 20.5 million jobs and an unemployment rate that has shot up to 14.7%. Now, the U6 rate, which includes unemployed and underemployed, was 22.8%. Now, get this part. Average hourly earnings were up 4.7%. Everybody got a raise during the shut-in. No, that's not what happened. The bulk of the destruction in job losses has been felt by lower paid workers, typically low-skilled workers, workers that are probably a lot more easily replaced than higher-skilled workers when it comes time to rehire and reopen businesses. Also, there was some notes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that the unemployment number is likely underestimating the actual rate because there were many people who not working, staying at home during all this period, maybe they're not sick or this and that, have referenced that they've been classified as unemployed on temporary layoff when instead they were classified as employed, but not at work. There's a huge difference. Let me go back over that one more time. There are many workers that classify themselves as employed, but not at work, when they should have them classify themselves as unemployed on temporary layoff. Now, the BLS estimates that by changing that small classification would have shot unemployment rate up near 20%. In all, I hope this report cements that there's just no way we're going to see a V-like recovery in the economy. States are opening up in phases. Many work areas are not going to be the same like they were 2 months ago. I know we're looking at many options of how we're bringing up our office back in phases, maybe allowing a voluntary phase in the first portion and then finally getting back to a more required time at the office. But we continue to see the grass shoots, as they used to call them back in 2009 when the recession was starting to get better and less bad. And we're encouraged by many of the hardest hit states that have a plan to reopen. Case in point is like California. While stocks have recovered nicely off the March lows, the one area that hasn't is treasury yields. The 10-year yield continues to hover right between 0.6% and 0.8% for the past month, and the massive level of money market accounts still shows that many investors have been shell-shocked from the volatility in March and continue to play things safe. My brother and I, we were taking a look at things on Monday in our investment meeting, and Chris showed ICI data that showed all money market funds have totaled around $4.76 trillion as of May 6th. That's a huge level. Just to give you a comparison here, back in 2008, the highest this figure got was $3.9 trillion. So yes, inflation is involved here, but wow, $4.76 trillion compared to the last severe recession in the country of only $3.9 trillion in cash. We also show that ICI is giving us data that shows fund flows continue to leave equities and move into money markets. That's a lot of investment that has missed the bottom and I believe will continue to support any kind of downside risk. That FOMO, that fear of missing out of this rally, will likely cushion some downside weakness. But it does also serve our opinion that the upside will also be capped with valuation concerns as they are high right now. You know, we've got earnings have declined, prices have recently come back up. So that's not a great spot to be in for anybody entering into the market. And I just want to quote our recent commentary from Buffett last weekend, who said that he's having a very hard time finding any attractive opportunities in the market right now. But that's it for this week's news and catalysts on the financial markets.
Back in February, we spoke with Dr. Nada Sanders, a global supply chain expert, keynote speaker, and author of numerous books on the global supply chain, risk management, and predictive analytics. In February, she told our audience that she was forecasting a global recession to hit this year because of what we were seeing in China. Now that we are seeing a recession underway, similar to, if not greater than what we saw in 2008-2009, we caught up with Dr. Sanders this week to get an update on her outlook, given how things have transpired since. Here's a clip of what she had to tell listeners this week on FS Insider.
I think, unfortunately, we're going into a deep global recession, and I think it's going to be protracted. I think people need to really brace themselves. Companies that had been focused on growth, I think it is important to recognize we're not in that period now, but you want to tread water, you want to get through this period, and you want to be super creative. And this is where I had mentioned in terms of pivoting, rebranding. You know, some of our greatest brands came out of the Spanish flu out of 1918. And some of it was really just great marketing. It was really tremendously creative. So Lysol, for example, that we all are out of stock now, right? All your listeners know. You know, Lysol, such an amazing product, which, by the way, we're going to see shortages probably well through the summer of Lysol. But Lysol actually was developed in the late 1800s, but actually didn't have a lot of uses for it. And it was only in 1918 with the Spanish flu that the company ended up with something like 5 or 6 different targeted marketing campaigns in terms of how to use Lysol to protect against the pandemic. And it was incredibly creative. That had launched this brand.
As always, if you'd like to hear this full interview, in addition to our 3 other interviews airing every week on FS Insider with book authors, industry experts, and investment strategists from around the world, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, stocks are still in an upswing. It's been one heck of a recovery as it's been one heck of a downturn. So will this recovery continue? Where are the best places to be in this kind of stock market? What sectors? Joining us on the program is Dave Keller. He's Chief Market Strategist at StockCharts.com. Dave, let's talk about 3 major indexes. I want to talk about the S&P, the Dow, and then the NASDAQ. Comparing them, the NASDAQ has just been soaring like a NASA space launch.
That's such a great visual for how the chart actually looks, Jim. So that's a fair comparison. There's no doubt. I think the speed of the recovery has been really impressive out of the March lows from the third, fourth week in March. And technology, the sector has been leading not just out of the lows, but it's been an outperformer pretty consistently. So if you're looking at the NASDAQ compared to the S&P, you certainly see that strength from technology, and I've argued from a technical perspective, lines up to be sort of a core position. It's something that continues to outperform in down cycles and in up cycles. And so as a result, you have a situation where when people are optimistic and they feel like things are going to recover, they're going to the part of technology like semiconductors and other things that should help us if we are in a recovery phase. But when things get difficult, they go to big defensive parts of tech like Apple and Microsoft and names like that. As a result, it ends up being a pretty consistent outperformer, to be honest with you.
Yeah, the only other sector that I see that even looks close like this on the charts are the healthcare sector.
That's exactly right. And you had with healthcare, I think biotechs are probably the best example of the leadership in healthcare. When technology over the last 6 weeks had a bit after the initial move, the V bottom that came so quickly, tech on a relative basis sort of tapered off for a little bit while healthcare really emerged and continued to outperform. It was really driven by the biotechs and its names like Regeneron, which are just incredible charts, sort of up and to the right, long and strong, consistent performers, making new highs or testing new highs consistently. So in a really good place. But then you started to see other parts of healthcare like medical supplies, like big pharma actually performing pretty well. That started to unwind a little bit. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of strategists, myself including, have been looking at sort of that next level down and seeing what sort of rotations we're seeing between sectors and also between groups within those sectors.
I also want to talk about another sector that's held up, and that is some of the big box stores, whether you're looking at Walmart, Target, Costco, and of course, Amazon, which, you know, it's considered a tech company because of their cloud computing, but it's also considered a retailer.
That's exactly right. And what you described, I mean, really, it's not just the sectors that you just alluded to, but it's also the mega cap trade, right? So people have talked about the FANG trade for years, and it became sort of the MAGA trade, the Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, Google, and all of those, Apple. And so, you know, these big, huge mega caps are what have really driven things. And what is interesting right now from a technical perspective is if you look a little further down the cap tiers, you have certain days where there's a lot more distribution in small cap stocks, in mid cap stocks, whereas the mega cap indexes like the S&P 100 actually hold up really well. And that's usually a way of describing a very narrowly led market, and usually at the later stages of a bull market run where you have people, you know, taking profits on more of the speculative high beta names, going to more big defensive stocks like Microsoft and Amazon, the ones you mentioned. What happens is the overall S&P 500 will continue to drift higher because those stocks are such a big weight in the index. So if they're doing well, the index as a whole is going to look pretty good. And you have a situation where some of the smaller cap names, some of the higher beta, more higher risk names will actually start to break down first. And the last thing that would roll over would be the S&P 500 because it's held up by some of those mega cap defensive stocks. And tech for a long time has been considered offense. That's sort of the offensive side. That's the long and strong, you know, new economy, things doing well, but they're actually functioning more like a defensive sector recently.
So as you're looking at this, and we've had this kind of V-shaped bounce, very strong in the technology sector, which held up better on the downturn, but also right out of the gates on the upturn, are you seeing anything that would be diverging that would alert you that, hey, maybe we're going to consolidate here, or maybe we could end into a correction? Anything that's diverging?
So, it's a great question. And I would say, you know, what's interesting about this environment is I think the market has found a way to validate everyone's outlook. So if you're really bullish and you're optimistic about the economy reopening and states starting to loosen the restrictions and companies, you know, recovering and the economy charging and the market can go higher, you're getting plenty of evidence with the S&P in the short term making higher highs, higher lows, continuing this uptrend. But if you're more bearish, if you're more constructive long term on the market, what's happened, it's not necessarily divergences, but you're finding that the S&P retraced about 61.8% of that February to March sell-off. So if you take the high from February, you take the low from March and you connect those two, 61.8%, which is one of those Fibonacci levels a lot of traders, a lot of investors follow, that's right around 29.35 on the S&P. We went just above there, just above 29.50, and then pulled back. And so if, I asked my four-year-old Henry to draw with a crayon, you know your market history, Henry, draw me a standard bear market rally, it would be about what we've seen here. So if you're long-term bearish, we've had the quick rally that happened in the late 1920s, early 30s, you had that. With any major bear market phase, you have one of these really violent, quick bear market rallies that suck so many people in before the next leg down. So I think the challenge right now is everyone feels a little bit validated. And I would say most people expecting at least some pullback here. And I think that's totally justifiable. In terms of divergences, I think, you know, what concerns me are any stocks that are not holding up well. So for me, financials and the underperformance of financials is probably one of the biggest question marks and things you have to be worried about. You know, if the world's getting better, if things are recovering, if the economy is working well, you would expect big financial institutions to be in a position to benefit from that. But that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing the things that are doing well are healthcare stocks that are going to get us out of this from a medical perspective. Technology stocks that are going to allow us to do calls like this from our homes. It's community, you know, consumer names like Amazon that allow us to buy things. It's networking names. But it's not the big banks or the old economy things that would do well if things are really getting better. So until you see financials sort of participate, I think you have to be skeptical about a lot of further upside. If you look at a chart of like JP Morgan, it's starting to break down a little bit along with a lot of the other banks as well.
I want to move on to commodities, and I want to talk about two in particular, oil and gold. And then, Dave, I want to ask you about the dynamics of this market that make it different. The algo trading and the amount of money going into index funds kind of accelerated the upturn and gave us big valuations on these big FANG stocks, mega cap stocks. And then on the downturn, accelerated on the downturn, just as, for example, these commodity funds like USO are wreaking havoc in the oil market.
Yeah, there are a lot. There's a lot to uncover there. With your last point, I think what this is has seen. I know talking with investors over the years, we've always debated in the industry about ETFs and structures that have evolved. And the challenge I've seen is that none of these ETF products, or very few of them, have really been battle tested in a bear market phase. And while they're structured to navigate those okay. The USO never has been tested with, crude oil going straight down, with the futures going negative. That is completely new. So how the USO performs around that is sort of a question mark. But a lot of investors treat them as if they have been battle tested and that they know what exposure they're getting to. So with something like the USO, I think that's very much a sort of caveat emptor, let the buyer beware scenario where, with something like a commodity ETF, there's a built-in decay because every quarter, every month, depending on what product you're looking at, it has to roll over to another contract, which automatically is going to eat up some of the value of the ETF. So you're basically, over the long term, going to lose money on that unless there's a huge rally in oil. And when you saw oil come down, you saw things like the USO really struggle to keep up with what was happening. And a lot of investors, I think, were caught off guard by that. So this has been a situation where a lot of new experiences are being had. And I would always love people to understand that and learn from someone else's money losses, someone else's capital losses, and not their own, if at all possible. So I think that's one certain challenge with some of those commodity ETFs that you alluded to.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me, do you remember this? What was it? I think coming out of 2018, the volatility funds that got just crushed.
That's exactly right. And again, it's usually, the industry and the market does very well at creating products that will benefit from a certain conflagration of events. But when things change, a lot of times it's unknown and there are unintended consequences that come with some of these products that you really only learn when the unknown or the unexpected happened. And so that's sort of what we've seen with crude oil. Having said that, you asked about just the oil and gold with the commodities. Commodities got so bombed out so quickly, and crude oil is just one of many that really fell off a cliff and evaporated. And while one of those, some of the commodity contracts went negative, the sort of core benchmark we followed, stayed in the single digits, but still very, very depressed. But what's happened, if you think stocks made a quick V bottom, look at the crude oil contract or crude oil future, because it reverted right back to its previous highs very, very quickly. With crude oil getting back into the mid-20s, almost in a couple weeks. And so what's happened is a lot of energy stocks, if we look at stocks with the best percent moves in the last week or two, maybe the last 2 weeks, I would assume that most of that list is going to be big energy stocks that have, gained 20%+ coming out of the lows. And I think what's happened is they were completely bombed out. Now we've overcompensated on the upside, and now things start to settle down a little bit. Crude oil's back in that mid-20s range. Energy stocks still doing okay, but sort of now back into the previous highs. And I think the question now is more sustainability of some of those moves.
Yeah, you look at some of these big cap stocks like Chevron. You could lay Chevron over the Nasdaq, and they almost look the same.
It's true. And if you look at the relative performance, especially over the last 6 months or last 6 weeks, you'd be hard pressed to find stocks as a group that did better than some of those big energy names, Chevron, E&P stocks. With huge returns coming out of the lows. But again, that's coming off of a very depressed level. I think a lot of times investors get caught up in that trap of percent gain. So if something gains 20% after losing 60%, you're still down a lot. So let's not get too excited about the short-term percent returns. And that's why I think charts can be really, really helpful to visually see that change in dynamic.
Let's talk about two other sectors. I want to go over to interest rates. You know, we had a strategist on our show 3 years ago, well-known Wall Street strategist. And at that time, the Fed was raising interest rates. 10-year treasuries were over 3%. And he said, we're going to go to below 1% on treasuries and $10 oil. And Dave, the response we got, like, that guy's a nut job. Don't have him back. But look where we are today. 10-year treasuries are a little over 0.6%, and oil actually went $40 negative.
That's exactly right. And it, you know, the joke we always have made as technicians is never confuse the bottom of the page with support. And we get so caught up in it is a mental block. It is part of how we're wired to see patterns. And so we assume that there are boundaries, that there are ranges baked into the prices of things. And if you think interest rates can't go below zero, they can. And we've seen it elsewhere. If you think commodities can't go below zero, they can. We've now seen that with crude oil. And so I think it's, to be honest with you, it's similar to, you know, the Apollo 1 fire where the Apollo capsule, you know, was set, it burned out on the launch pad. The astronauts unfortunately passed away. And Frank Borman, when interviewed afterwards, said it was a failure of imagination. We just didn't imagine that was a scenario we would need to prepare for. So we were ready for it. And I think that's a similar situation I think a lot of investors are learning about, is we weren't maybe mentally prepared for stocks to go down 30%, for interest rates to go below zero, or even to go below 1%. That seems, you know, that seemed ridiculous not too long ago. So I think a lot of times if you catch yourself thinking, well, it can't go much lower because it's already gone down this much, there are plenty of examples through market history where things can go much further, where that first leg down is the first of multiple legs down, which seem way more reasonable after the fact. In the rear view mirror, they make sense, but ahead of time, they don't. So with interest rates, when people tell me, well, interest bonds can't do much better because interest rates have already come down so much, my answer always is, that's what we said a couple points ago before they came down this much. There is no, you know, there are theoretical bottoms to certain things. A stock literally can't go below zero, but a lot of things can, and they will. And I think the same thing, if you look at the TLT, which is one of the more liquid long bond ETFs, sort of a good proxy for bond prices, you know, same thing. It's rallied so much and interest rates are so low. How high could bonds go? And my answer is, if it keeps going up, the answer is it can go further. And there are situations where bonds do well and stocks do poorly. And if you're just not in the right mindset, you're not going to be prepared for that to happen. But I think that's the situation that we've seen. The TLT has pulled back to its 50-day moving average, which is usually sort of a nice pullback within a longer-term uptrend. It appears to be finding support. And overall, I think bond prices look pretty good. And I think interest rates can remain lower a lot longer than people could expect.
Let's talk about a commodity that's done very well. It's broken out and many expect it to go higher. What's your opinion on the charts on gold?
So, you know, again, to start with, you know, think about stocks. So gold and then the gold stocks, gold miners like Newmont Mining are always interesting to look at relative to one another. And I think if you look at the chart of NEM, Newmont Mining, again, you'd be hard pressed to find a stock that's in a better relative position than Newmont Mining here, even relative to technology and some of the big consumer names. It's just done very, very well. It's been in a nice, consistent, secular uptrend. The relative performance has been good. And I think that's driven by a chart of gold that's actually been pretty consistently positive as well. If you look at the two-year chart of gold, it's had this consistent pattern of higher highs and higher lows. And again, we can debate whether gold is operating as a safe haven or whether it's more speculative or whatever. And I think that's more water cooler discussion. What I'm more concerned is, where are the trends evolving? And with gold, I see something that's almost at another all-time high or a long-term high, continues to make higher highs. It pulled back along with a lot of stocks, and really it pulled back a little later, sort of in mid-March, but then is now back above the peak from February, testing another new high. The relative strength has come down, so it's been outperforming stocks just in the last 6 weeks or so because of how quickly the V-bottom has played out. But I think if you get that sideways to down period in stocks that I think is pretty safe to assume here, something like gold, even if it remains in a similar level to where it has, it's going to actually emerge in a pretty good relative position. And I think, again, as a long-term chart, gold is one of the better long-term plays that we've seen.
Because if you look at a long-term chart of gold, we had the steep sell-off, you know, after 2011 all the way down to the bottom in 2016. Then we had a steep rise, and then it kind of went just consolidated and sideways for almost 2 years, but until recently where it looks like it's breaking out.
That's exactly right. And I think what happens with a lot of things with gold, and even, you know, you mentioned healthcare earlier, there was a period not too long ago where healthcare was almost something you mentally pushed aside because it just really wasn't doing anything compared to the overall market, right? There wasn't real any benefit to owning healthcare stocks versus other names because other sectors were doing better or worse consistently. Gold, I think a lot of people mentally wrote off with equities in such a consistent uptrend, 10 plus year bull market. Why would you ever want to go own gold when you can own stocks and they keep going up? The moment that picture changes on stocks, which is I think what we're still starting to process, this movement in gold starts to look more and more on a relative basis, more and more compelling. And you're right. If you look at a longer term chart, like the last 10, 15 years on gold, pretty impressive sort of distribution phase in the early 2010s, stabilizing in the middle of the last decade. And then over the last couple of years, really emerging in a position of strength. And I think that's going to continue here for the foreseeable future.
So from your perspective, as you're looking at the market, we've had this V-shaped recovery, especially very strong in the NASDAQ, you know, the QQQs, also in healthcare, in gold. As an investor, what would you be doing at this point? A lot of people got scared out when the steep sell-off, they've gone to cash and they've kind of missed out on a lot of this. As an investor, what would you be doing? Would you be more cautious? Or would you be okay deploying some money in certain sectors that look the strongest?
That's a great question. And I would say the answer on that depends really on your time frame. So if you're in a retirement account and you're betting for 10, 20, 30 years down the road, I think overall, if you zoom out of any bear market move like we've just seen, 100% of the time, every move like this has been followed by some bull market that pushes the market to new highs. And I don't see that pattern ending for the foreseeable future. I think that's a pattern that will continue to, you know, to continue to emerge. And so I think if your runway is long enough, you're going to find over the next couple of weeks, next couple of months, a lot of really good companies with long-term prospects that you can get at a bargain. And that's pretty compelling. If you're more short-term, more tactical, I think you have to be prepared for this rally. The V bottom, like you've seen, is pretty classic of bear market rallies. And it's driven by that fear of missing out, that FOMO. And people that missed out on the bottom have tried to get back in. And that's why the market's rallied very quickly from any sort of pullback. But what happens in a classic bear market phase is you get to that point where you now all of a sudden can't justify the market going much further. Stocks that have recovered, you really don't see the world getting back to normal. It's just, it's not as bad as it was a little bit before. And that evaporates the buying pressure and that causes the next leg down that I think a lot of people, myself included, are sort of expecting. So I think tactically, you have to be prepared for a downturn of sorts. I don't know necessarily that we would reach the previous lows from March or break below them. But I think, you know, over the coming weeks and months, I think we're going to be closer to the lower end of this range than where we are now. And that means being patient and waiting for a better opportunity to get in is probably going to serve you better in the long term.
Yeah, it almost reminds me now that we're in May, sell the end of May, go away and come back after Labor Day. I just wonder because there is a discrepancy from the way the stock market is reacting in a V-shape, where you're taking a look at some of the economic numbers, which are just looking horrific. I mean, 33 million unemployment claims filed as of this last week.
That's exactly right. And I think if you look at the economic data, if you look at the news flow, it's not great news that we're necessarily seeing, but the market has moved up in spite of that. And again, that just to me doesn't feel necessarily sustainable. The kicker is, and you have to remember, right, two things. With the cyclical nature of what you mentioned, right, that sell in May and go away theory has held water. I mean, over the long term, we are entering the seasonally weakest part of the year. So on average, if you get out of the market from May to November, get back in general, you're going to do much better over the long term than if you just buy and hold through the entire course of the year. Having said that, we're sort of in this unusual circumstance we're not normally in with the coronavirus, and it's a lot of unknowns. But having said that, I think to your point of sort of the long-term evolution of the trends, we have to pay attention to what the market is doing. And the stock market tends to be a leading indicator for the economy. If you want to get a read on where the economy is most likely headed, you should look at stocks because they're one of the better leading indicators of economic growth over time. So I think stocks will start to recover probably while the headlines are still more negative than positive, and then the headlines will start to improve over time. That's usually what's happened historically.
So if I was summing up, you probably are expecting a correction here, that this is looking more, at least at this point, a typical bear market rally. And I think you bring up a point most people forget about. Some of the most explosive rallies in the stock market have come as counter trend rallies in a bear market.
Yeah. And if you look back at market history, and again, I don't think we're in a Great Depression sort of period. So don't draw that conclusion by what I'm about to say. But one of the biggest, you know, most impressive bull market, short-term bull market runs we've seen is right after the first leg down in sort of the late 20s into the early 30s. That first leg back up after the initial sell-off is very similar to this. We retraced about 50% of the previous sell-off, a little bit more than that. Things felt great, but if you zoom out, it feels like just this initial move among many other ones. So this is classic for that first initial period of what can often become a much longer, much more painful bear market. So for me, I think it's all about watching the trends, watching the charts, and paying attention to where the prices are actually headed. I think if you do that, you're going to be able to be on the right side of things.
Yeah, you mentioned the Great Depression in that bear market rally coming out of those market lows. It trapped one of the greatest traders in history, Jesse Livermore, who made a fortune shorting the stock market ahead of the crash. I think it was 1931. He got all in. He thought that was the bottom, and he lost a lot of money.
And I was going to say, every great investor has at least one good story like that, where they've been completely on the wrong side of things. And I hope your listeners are not going to create their own story during this period of being a little too eager to get back into things. But you're right. I think it's a perfect parallel. You read his writings, or Edwin Lefebvre's writings about Jesse Livermore and how he went through that period. There's a lot to gain from this. I'm also actually reading Once in Golconda, talking about the 1920s and 30s. There are a lot of interesting parallels to what we've seen now.
As we close, why don't you tell our listeners about stock charts? In one of my favorite pages on your software program is the Market Summary page.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jim. And again, I'm a huge fan of your program and what you're doing. I'm thrilled to be a part of it. I appreciate you inviting me on. You know, with stock charts, our goal is to empower individual investors to take control of their finances, make better decisions. And we usually use visualization, data visualization, and technical analysis as part of the toolkit to help you make better decisions. And we do it through exceptional tools, through expert commentary, and through education, and so on. Stockcharts.com, you're going to find all three of those, hopefully pretty well covered. You hit on the market summary page, and I would say the market dashboard a lot of our users use as well are two really good places to look on our platform, because it's driven by the charts, it's driven by the trends and what's working and what isn't. And so we have a lot of ways of breaking down the equity universe, breaking down ETFs, breaking down industries, sorting them based on their relative performance, and focusing on what's working and what isn't. So certainly check it out on stockcharts.com. I hope to have your listeners there.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite pages. It's my go-to page in the morning, because when I go to your market summary page, I can literally go around the world in every asset class and see it all on one page. And what I really like, over the last year, you guys have added a chart to the side. So when I go to the major indexes, I can click on the NASDAQ, the Dow, the S&P 500, the Russell. And to the left, I see the chart. And if I want to blow it up, I just click on it. And there it is right on my screen.
Yeah, I won't take full credit for that. But we've been working a lot to try to upgrade the platform. And I think you've hit on it. We've certainly recognized over time the importance of the visual analysis as a way of understanding what's happening. And I think part of making good decisions is having a good market awareness, having a good awareness of what's happening. And I think, to your point, having the charts and being able to visually go through it, that's certainly part of my morning coffee routine. Get the cup of coffee. What do you go through so that you understand where things are at and where they may be headed? And I do, it sounds like a similar approach to what you just described.
Yeah. There. First thing I do, get up in the morning, walk into my study with a cup of coffee, go to your market summary page, and take a trip around the world. Well, listen, Dave, thanks so much for joining us on the program. And once again, the program is called Stock Charts, all one word, stockcharts.com. Dave, thanks for joining us. Stay safe and have a great weekend.
Thanks so much, Jim. Take care.
The United States and China are locked in a cold tech war, and the winner will end up dominating the 21st century. Beijing was not considered a tech contender a decade ago. Now some call it a leader. So writes Gordon Chang, the author of a recent booklet titled The Great U.S.-China Tech War. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners this week on FS Insider.
We're behind in two areas in particular. One of them is 5G. China's Huawei Technologies is wiring much of the world. We don't have an American company that provides a comprehensive solution, which means that China will be able to filch a lot of data, which will feed into its artificial intelligence systems. The second area where we're far behind is quantum communications. Beijing has figured out how to use this spooky phenomena, as Albert Einstein called it, of particles at great distances moving in tandem. They've already got communication satellites on quantum. They've got quantum communications on the ground between Beijing and Shanghai. If you look into the future, you've got to be concerned if you're an American. China, because of Huawei Technologies, will be able to get a lot more data than we'll have access to. Also, the Chinese Communist Party doesn't have concerns about privacy. They're able to run roughshod over the Chinese people. They'll be able to collect data like we won't be able to. And the more data you have, the better your AI is. So that's a very important trend favoring China.
This was a very thought-provoking interview, and we covered a lot of material with Gordon Chang. If you want to hear this full interview, in addition to our other three interviews airing every week on FS Insider, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
We got some more bad news on the unemployment front. Unemployment claims jumped by another 3.1 million. 33 million Americans are out of work, and the unemployment rate could be close to 15 to 16%. Where is this all heading? The gold markets, the oil markets, all of that? Let's talk with Greg Weldon from Greg Weldon Online. Greg, let's look at some of these economic numbers. And one of the things that really hits me is you can't shut down an economy the way we've been doing and keep it shut down for a long period of time without destroying the economy itself. There are a lot of businesses, Greg. I was at a strip mall. The AMC just filed for bankruptcy. The Pilates studio wasn't open up. About the only thing that was open was the grocery store. So how do you run an economy when you shut everything down?
There's a couple things that come to mind, you know, almost right away. And the first one is, I mean, aren't businesses, aren't people in general, households, you know, I mean, are just supposed to, I mean, what happened to the old adage, you want to have 6 months of your bills, you know, in savings for the case of a rainy day or an emergency or, you know, some kind of event like this. So it's amazing to see how quickly the economy collapses, how quickly people are filing for bankruptcy. I mean, you know, at worst, we're inside of, you know, roughly 2 months. Some places in the northwest of the U.S. might be 2.5 months. But, I mean, holy mackerel. And then from there, regional Fed surveys last week had a treasure trove of information. One of the things that it told us was, small businesses are doing one of four things. If they're not taking in government money, which was slow to flow, number one, they're doing one of three other things, which is tapping cash reserves, tapping existing lines of credit or opening new lines of credit or taking out additional bank loans. So you're saying inside of 2 months, so many companies, so many businesses, and even large businesses, not just, you know, small businesses, don't have enough cash to operate, you know, for 3 months without, you know, without running into bankruptcy issues, solvency issues. And now if you have another event, whether it be, you know, Italy or Spain, whether it be Japan, whether it be some natural event, or whether it be a round two of this virus, which we know is coming, we're going to go back too early because the economic pain is too much to bear. So what's going to happen then? I mean, the cushion is gone. The emergency cushion, it didn't exist. And now you're borrowing more money, probably, you know, to your maximum. I mean, you've removed the cushion. So, you know, the risk dynamic automatically, by definition, goes up significantly. That's not reflected in the stock market at all. Round two of this outbreak, not reflected in the stock market at all. I think the unemployment dynamic is critical because the Fed surveys also told us two other things. Three other things, actually. Number one, that 37.4% of firms, according to three regional Fed surveys, are not going to hire back all the workers they laid off. They estimate that 24.9%, 0.1% shy of 1/4 of those jobs lost, the 30 million people applying for unemployment benefits are going to be permanent. That's 9 million jobs, and I think, frankly, that's a conservative estimate. All right. This dynamic doesn't play for a V recovery. This dynamic doesn't play for a stock market that is pricing in a V recovery. And I think there's one person, someone that I've worked with in the past, that I've spoken with in the past, I used to write for his website, that I have the utmost respect for, is Jim Grant. We both know who Jim Grant is. And I think he said it as perfectly, as eloquently, and as simplistically in the true Jim Grant style of, you know, when he's able to use as least words as possible, which is hard for him, hard for me, he really nails it. And he said, the stock market is mistaking liquidity for solvency. And that nails it on the head, because the solvency issue is real. It's going to hit hard, and the stock market hasn't dealt with it. So, you know, I think it's, and then the other thing I would say is, are you going to bail out every industry, every business, every small business owner, every household? Are you going to bail out every country? I mean, because this has happened everywhere in the world. Okay, you're talking about, you know, why is the dollar not going down? Is they're printing so much money, not to get ahead of ourselves? But it's interesting to see that. It's because all these other currencies are getting wasted. When you look at what's happening in places that are especially commodity sensitive, a place like Angola, Nigeria, Uzbekistan, Argentina, Brazil, South Africa. I mean, it could run the countries off where the currencies are getting smoked, right? So what is the Fed going to do? They're going to buy Uzbekistan SOM price bonds? Are they going to buy Zimbabwean bonds? I mean, you can't save everyone. And even to try and basically kind of bail out the U.S., are they willing to go to a balance sheet of $20 trillion? Because the math kind of suggests, you know, that's where you might have to take this thing. So I think there's a lot of landmines in the playing field right now. And thinking that we can, you know, get across this field without stepping on at least one of them, if not multiple landmines, I think is naive and short-sighted.
And speaking of landmines, I want to talk about the energy market. We were consuming about 100 million barrels, and we just lost about 25 million barrels. People aren't on planes. If you're quarantined, your car's in the garage, you're not driving to work or taking vacations. So let's talk about energy. You work in the futures market, and I wonder if you would explain for our listeners, because I think this is really important. One of the investment vehicles that people have tried to play the oil market thinking it's bottom is USO. We saw that blow up last month as they couldn't roll over those contracts, and USO is not in the business of taking delivery for oil. So, Greg, the estimates I see by the middle of this month or towards the end of this month, Cushing is going to be full, and yet USO is taking more money. I wonder if you would explain how a fund like USO works and why it's almost like you're going to lose money, because most of the time the markets are in contango. Could you explain for our listeners contango and backwardation and why that doesn't work out well for USO investors?
Yeah, it is the problem with the spreads. And when you're in a backwardation state, it means that the near-term price is higher, right? So, and that's, you know, the market functioning to draw inventory into the market to meet demand. So if you're in a backwardation, it suggests either supply is low or demand is high or some combination of the two that generates a functioning of the market itself to bring physical material to the market. Of course, the opposite is contango, where the near-term contract is priced at a discount to the deferred months. And that is a situation which is usually bearish and trying to keep crude oil from coming to the market. But then you run into the problem, like you mentioned, of storage. And if you can't store the crude that you're going to take delivery on, you best not take delivery on it, because now you're going to have to ship it somewhere else, find a home for it. You know what the pricing dynamic is once you're over the barrel, pun intended. You know, you're kind of screwed. So it creates all kinds of issues. And what we saw, of course, in the meltdown in the spot contract that expired recently to minus $40 a barrel shows you how desperate people were to not take delivery, okay? Because finding storage space and paying for it, theoretically, could cost you more than $40 a barrel. So a whole wide range of things come out of this. Number one, I've been saying all along, and it's very unfortunate because I was the first guy that wanted to love ETFs. They don't work the way they should. They don't replicate the underlying price of most commodities for these very reasons, because you have these big spreads, particularly in energy, where I mean, as recently as, you know, just a week ago, the June crude spread was minus $20. All right, meaning that, you know, the market is saying, you know, crude is so cheap right now that you can look at it one of two ways. I mean, what the functioning is that's a very bearish market because you get such a lower price to actually deliver crude oil, all right, because the market doesn't need it. So they're going to pay you less than if you store it, all right? But it also kind of does suggest to some degree, Jim, that, you know, supply-demand and the functioning of the market works, that when you have this dynamic around disinvestment and you have these cutbacks to production, that that will lift prices in the future. And you could take that same whole argument of this is a bearish near-term signal to say this says that the market is implying that that crude oil will be much more balanced a year from now to the point where the price will be $20 higher, all right? So it's not always black and white. And the risk to any of these ETFs are that you're not going to get paid the way you should get paid. It's one of the reasons I don't like paying premium for options. And it's one of the reasons you have to be very careful with trying to replicate a commodities position in the ETF market. It often doesn't work. You could say the same thing for the bearish ETFs, the way they have to kind of remark themselves and, you know, they pay dividends. And there's all, I mean, every ETF is different. There's no standardized contract for ETFs. And you get the leveraged ETFs, like, you know, the Nugget, for example, and the precious metals. I mean, you know, again, you know, it will fall incrementally more than the underlying product, and that's why you're playing it. So it will rise more than it will incrementally when gold goes up or the mining shares go up. But it also works, you know, dramatically in reverse, especially when you tie in some of these other factors. I don't trust the ETFs. I don't, you know, if you want to play a sector allocation in the stock market, biotech, healthcare, consumer staples, great. ETFs are wonderful. You want to try and replicate a commodity trading advisor portfolio using ETFs? Good luck. It's very difficult.
Yeah, you're going to lose money. Well, let's speak about another commodity. You talked about this issue that Jim Grant talked about. The market is mistaking liquidity for solvency. And we're talking about, we're seeing debt levels and we're seeing the Fed. Gosh, I listed all the things they're backstopping. They're backstopping money market funds, the commercial paper market, the treasury market, the mortgage market, the commercial paper market, currency swaps with foreign governments. Now they're going into ETFs on the bond side, junk bonds. I mean, Greg, what the hell are they not backing up?
Well, I mean, that's pretty much what I said before. I mean, you know, are you going to save every business, every industry, every market, every person? I mean, think about the BOJ, which just laid out 28 trillion yen to buy household debt. All right. So I could easily envision this being something that people start demanding from the Fed down the line. And what it really comes down to, Jim, as you know, I mean, we're both, you know, really hardcore market veterans, that you're watching the bond market for signs of, you know, oops, that's too much, okay? Because that epiphany, if you will, I've made so many analogies to these things over the years. And one of the things we used to talk about in the context of Japan and the potential for a big blow up in the JGB market is the emperor with no clothes. I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to. This is the emperor with no clothes. And the second the emperor, you know, the little kid says, mommy, he's naked, you know, all hell breaks loose in bond markets around the world because guess what? Governments are naked right here. Central banks are naked right here. If you recall previous conversations we've had on your program, central banks back in the end of the summer were very concerned, particularly the Fed. They marched out, you know, regional president after regional president using the same exact words in their speeches, which is not coincidence, all right? And they were talking about two things, inflation expectations becoming unanchored, and the fact that our star, which is the natural neutral rate of Fed funds, okay, relative to inflation, all right, in this whole nine yards. So global R-star for the developed countries, 50 basis points. In other words, at 50 basis points, you're neutral. How are you supposed to get easy when in the past, easy has been 350 to 450 basis points below inflation, all right? So that's not going to happen. All right, and there's a point that comes to where if you know you print so much money that the currency loses its efficacy, if you can call it that. And so I'm watching two things. I'm watching European bond markets because Spain and Italy will be the first ones to go There's a whole litany of reasons that we could discuss for an hour on those two places. Spain has linkage to Turkey. The lira in Turkey is at a record low. They have more external debt due this year, or in the next 12 months, I should say, than they have official FX reserves. Spain has about $110 billion in bad loans to Turkish banks and companies. France is right there with $75 billion. So you're talking almost a quarter of a trillion euro in loans to Turkey that could go bad. Turkey could backfire into Spain, which has its own issues. Two separatist parties that the socialists engaged to create their coalition when they stole power from Rajoy. You know, we know the situation in Italy. They need aid. They don't, aren't going to get it from the EU. So likely they're going to secede and bring back the lira so they can print money. These are two bond markets that have, sovereign debt to GDP ratios exceeding 100%. So when I watch bond markets, I watch Spain and Italy, Japan to a lesser extent. But I also watch the dollar, because the dollar is going to be key in this, Jim, and it hasn't cracked. And to me, that says that the Fed hasn't done enough yet, all right, because the dollar needs to crack. You can't have the dollar break out through 104 and make a run to 120. That'll jack the rates of change to levels that will only serve to intensify this crisis. It'll hit emerging markets. It will hit commodities. That would be really bad. The Fed has to avoid this. This is why they came out with their dollar swap plan when they did. Because the dollar was about to break out through, you know, the previous highs from 2-3 years ago, 103.80. All right. So, man, there's so much going on when you talk about central banks, when you talk about the Fed, and when you talk about how much money they're going to have to print. And ultimately, we know one thing for sure, that when the dollar goes, gold will be at new highs in dollars, because it's already at new highs in most every other paper currency on the planet, which is what's actually holding it back. In dollar terms.
That's a nice transition. Let's talk about gold. Gold is holding firm. It's been strong throughout this. And sooner or later, the dollar is going to have to crash. They're going to have to devalue or do something with all this debt. Let's talk about gold and where you see that going here.
Right now, it's tricky because it really could swing either way. If you take out the 1666 level on the June contract, you've got almost an immediate $100 of downside. Despite the fact that open interest has dropped, the funds and the specs are still kind of long. So there's a lot of game playing going on with the open interest and the commercial and the bank positions and silver and gold. Sometimes almost tough to handicap who's doing what and why. I think at the end of the day, it all spins a more bullish story. But I do think there is risk. The longer the dollar doesn't crack, the more the stock market's at risk, number one, and the more the gold market's at risk to some kind of purge. And there's still an outside risk that, you know, in the next wave of stock market, you know, epiphany, awakening, realization of the reality of the situation we're in, instead of this, oh, wow, there's, you know, a couple trillion dollars floating around, let's run up the stock market. That could be negative for gold if it's, you know, if it's in conjunction with the dollar that's moving higher. And that could be a case where gold goes down just less than everything else, and you kind of get this deflationary wave. That is still a very clear and present danger to the precious metals. Having said that, any $100, $150 dip in gold is a massive buying opportunity, because at the end of the day, the dollar will go. It's always the relief valve. It will be the relief valve again. And frankly, when you hear Jerome Powell say, you know, that we'll basically provide as much liquidity as we can to make sure there isn't a dollar shortage, what he's basically saying is kind of the reverse Draghi comment. We'll do whatever we have to make sure the dollar doesn't rally, and eventually it will crack. So I think the longer-term picture is so clearly bullish on gold, almost as if it's too perfect, but it's not, because it's exactly what it is. It's exactly what we've been saying it is. It's exactly what we've been saying it will be for the last 12 years, and you're at the point of attack right here. So the dollar will go. Gold will be above 2,000, and I expect that to be happening by the, you know, before the end of this year.
And, you know, the interesting thing, we talked about who they're not bailing out. My own state of California ran out of unemployment funds, so they're tapping loans from the government. And, Greg, it's not just California. It's other states that are going through the same problem, that are going through these shutdowns with major unemployment claims. They don't have the money. They're running out of money. Where are they getting it? They're getting it from the government.
But it does, Jim. It shows you what a house of cards it is. The whole thing. I mean, that goes back to the first comment I made. You know, you run 2 months and all of a sudden the entire economy is insolvent. I mean, that tells you what a house of cards it is. It tells you, and this ties into the oil story specifically as well, that credit is the lifeblood of this economy. We chose in 1971 And we reaffirmed that in 1990, 91, the last time we could have done the academically correct things here, right? Now, what they're going to do is not correct. It's not the academic right thing. It's not a solution. It's not the answers. It's the only option left because that's what they decided to do. So you're all in on this. You can't, it's, you know, the question is it a black hole? Is it a debt deflation black? And are we in the black hole already and we just don't know it? Because then you can't get out. And, you know, no matter how much energy is applied, light doesn't escape a black hole. Well, it's the same thing in terms of no matter how much money they print. If this is a debt deflation and you're into it already, it doesn't matter how much money they print. You're not getting out of it. But you come back to credit because this is really all about credit. What happened in oil reverberated through the credit markets in terms of financing commodity deals. I mean, this was like an earthquake that unleashed a tsunami that rolled through commodity credit markets, all right? Credit to the consumer, with the senior loan officer survey just out. Banks are scaling back. They're tightening credit conditions. We know this is happening. The Fed can't really do much to fight that, frankly, and it's their worst case scenario. When you get back to the states, I mean, this is where it gets messy, where it gets ugly again, where it gets political again in Washington. I mean, you know, one of the California leaders, you know, Nancy Pelosi would suggest, you know, let's have a guaranteed income and let's waive mortgage payments and, you know, let's give California a couple $1 trillion. Why? Because they've been the most irresponsible state in the union outside of maybe Illinois and New York. The three of them together, throw maybe Connecticut and New Jersey in the mix. All right. These states should be rewarded for being irresponsible for the last, you know, two decades. I mean, no, I don't see that. This is going to be a political battle in Washington that's going to be monumental and get a lot of negative press. You're setting up this whole thing to, we go back to work. We find out, guess what? Restaurants are going to go broke if they can only fill half capacity. Restaurants need to turn over full capacity three or four times on the weekends to make money. All right. It is a volume business with small margins. All right. So then think about all the commercial real estate entities that, you know, have properties that are, you know, leased to restaurants. I mean, think about the reverberations from all of that, let alone the employees, most of which are being laid off in leisure and hospitality, of course. So, man, it is so prevalent, and it is so applies to credit, and it so applies to solvency that it is beyond liquidity. And I think you're setting up for a massive epiphany in the stock market that comes when you have political wrangling in Washington over what to do with the states at a time when you start to realize the bankruptcies are really going to soar here, because as we go back to work, we're going to realize that, you know, you're going to try and go back to work, but you're going to have to define normal, because normal is not going to be what it used to be. Not even close.
Last weekend, I went to a strip mall. The AMC movie theater filed bankruptcy, closed. The stores, the restaurants, all closed. And quite honestly, even if we go back and we come out of this, can you imagine if we get a reoccurrence, because they still don't have a cure for this, let's say when we get to the...
And we will
in the flu season. Can you imagine what the Christmas retail season? Are you going to be out in a shopping mall with a mask and gloves on?
Nope. Same thing with Vegas. I mean, you know, you think about 9 million people unemployed. The other thing that I'd failed to mention before that came out of the Fed surveys, wages. Wages are going to be flat now. All right. So you've lost your wage growth. All right. Food and gasoline will eventually cost more. Food already does. All right. So food and gasoline prices going up. Wages are flat. Less people are working. You think people are going to be going to Vegas and laying odds on the craps table? No. You think people are going to be running out and spending more than they did last Christmas, this holiday season? No. All right. This is massive. You know, you think about everyone involved. The trickle down in this is mind blowing. It really is. And we, you know, if you go back to the first quarter Fed household credit survey, which is a massive report, it's like 160 pages. I go through every freaking page, every chart, every line, every data point. And what came out of this was before the outbreak was even on people's, you know, radar. Okay. Consumers were tightening their belt. Credit conditions were tightening. You saw revolving credit fall 2 out of 3 months. The rate of change in credit growth has come way down because your servicing costs are way up. If you're $370 billion a month to float your credit and, you know, retail sales are $480 billion a month, that's a pretty thin margin. You can't go upside down and stuff like this. The consumer is stretched. And I love how everyone talks about the consumer being so healthy. I don't see that. And the data doesn't support it. And one more thing I would add to that too is the delinquency rate on credit cards is important to watch. The seriously delinquent rate is back up pretty high. It's close to 6%. The overall rate is still low, okay? And even 6% on the seriously delinquent would be historically low, okay? So people are, you know, and I get this all the time. You know, you mentioned this. And people are, yeah, well, the delinquency rate is really low. What people don't understand is that the debt, the nominal amount of debt is so high that even a lower delinquency rate means more debt is delinquent upon than ever before. It exceeds the highs of 2007, 2008 in terms of the dollar amount of debt upon which consumers are delinquent on is a record high. None of this bodes well for a V recovery, let alone even like an L recovery. And I've been trying to figure out if then maybe you can help me or your listeners can help me. Is there a symbol in some language that is like an L with a droopy parallel line? In other words, like an L that angles downward, because that's what you're going to get, I think. You're going to get another decline in the stock market, and then it's just going to go sideways to down and bleed people dry. So if you don't have wealth in the stock market, you know, here's another way to look at it. I'll throw you one more, and I know I'm laying a lot of stuff out there, but it's such great material. You take retail sales. You take personal consumption expenditures. Last month, personal consumption expenditures were down by $1.12 trillion in a single month. April will be worse. You take retail sales, you take eating and drinking establishments. The decline already puts you back to 2014 levels, nominally speaking. Another decline of that proportion, which is the very least we're going to see in April, will take you back to levels last seen in 2005, 2006. Retail sales will be back to levels in 2012, if you know that plays out. So you've wiped out 8 to 12 years of growth, right, in consumer spending. And what you're left with is all the debt that paid for it. So thinking the consumer is going to come back fast, this is going to be a very long, drawn out, painful, you know, recovery from deeper levels than I think we've even seen yet or people understand.
I call it a depression. Well, listen, Greg, as we close, I want you to tell our listeners, you have written a book on the gold markets that really explains well how it functions. You have a new service. Tell our listeners about it and how they can take advantage of it.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, I wrote the book Gold Trading Bootcamp way back in 2006. We called the credit crisis and housing market, and we said gold would triple in price, and we were wrong. It went up by 4 times, not just 3. So, you know, we were calling for a move then from 450 to 1200. Obviously it reached 1900. I'm equally bullish now. And we did a gold trading boot camp. Okay, I was going to write another book. My publisher had been on me literally for years to write a second book. And I started to work on the book about a year and a half ago, just because I believed the time was right, that gold was ready to finally end this drawdown from 2011 and really get going. But what I found is, guess what? You can reach more people and you can actually make more money doing a boot camp, because writing books is a long, arduous process that really doesn't pay for the time that it takes to do it. So we did the boot camp, right, which is a gold trading boot camp. It's like 4 hours. It's 4 parts. It covers everything. I mean, from futures to to the mining shares, to the gold, to bullion, to coins, to bars, to the whole history of gold. I mean, to managing your risk in a portfolio, blah, 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 futures markets, everything. And what we got out of that is people wanted to have follow-up, and people wanted to track gold. And I used to do Prudential's, gold research. We used to have a product called the Metal Monitor that was strictly gold. So we resurrected this based on the need and the demand for it. It's called Gold Guru. It is gold-guru, G-U-R-U, gold-guru.com. And what we're doing right now, Jim, is, I run the institutional research business, which is, a very expensive product. We do the money management too, or CTA. So we wanted to get something that would be more in line with the average guy, Main Street, that needs the protection of gold and is not sure how to always navigate it. So gold-guru.com is the way to do that. It is only $60 a month, which, for my work, frankly, is a steal. And we're offering your clients an opportunity to get in for their first month at half price to try it out. Just use the code JIM, J-I-M, capital letters, 2020. And sign up and get half off gold-guru.com.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, lots of great stuff. Thanks for coming on the program. All the best. Stay safe.
You too, Jim.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
From the crisis in 2001 and the popping of the tech stock bubble, the Federal Reserve slammed interest rates and the Fed funds rate down to 50-year lows. Among other things, that created the lowest mortgage rates we've seen in 50 years. That helped to create the real estate bubble, which as part of this general exuberance, because of the very low interest rates and the elevated asset prices, that helped set off the mortgage derivatives collapse, which then led to the Federal Reserve slamming interest rates down to record lows in terms of 0%, which eventually, it's not an immediate process, it takes time for this to happen, which eventually created the highest asset prices yet. And now we have a third round of amplified crisis, which could lead to the greatest interventions yet. And yes, if it does work, the end result eventually, and I'm not saying 2020 or even 2021, could be the highest asset prices we've ever seen.
To listen to this full interview with Daniel Emmerman, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. Welcome, everybody, to today's Big Picture. Today, we're going to discuss recession, depression, and the road to serfdom. For those of you that don't know, The Road to Serfdom was a book written by Friedrich Hayek, published in 1944, and discusses the danger of what happens when you exchange personal and economic liberty for increasing government control and central planning of the economy, much of which will fit into today's discussion. Well, Jim, as we've been discussing on the show over the past few weeks and months, the expectation is for the economic data to get worse. We definitely saw that today and this week with the unemployment numbers coming out today showing a record 20.5 million jobs that were lost just in April alone. The unemployment rate jumping to just under 15% at 14.7. Both of these are now records in the post-World War II era. So Jim, let's start getting your big picture perspective on the economic numbers. Are things getting worse? Are they getting better? What's your assessment of the current situation?
Well, Chris, this is going to be a lot of looking like what we were told about the COVID virus. They told us in February, hey, this is going to be like a bell-shaped curve. It's going to climb. The death rate, the number of infections are all going to increase. Well, as you just mentioned, we are now in that bell-shaped curve of economic events that are going to be looking worse. The unemployment rate is going to be going higher. It's around 15, 16%, Chris. We could see by the time this thing bottoms, we could be at 20. Some experts like Janet Yellen, Fed Governor Bullard, thinks we could get up to 30. It really depends on how long we keep people locked down in businesses, which we'll get in. If we take a look at the ISM surveys, anything above 50 is considered an expanding economy. We went from over 50 to down to nearly 40 in just a matter of 1 month. You have, for example, states like California, which ran out of money for its unemployment insurance fund, so they are now borrowing money. And it's not just California, it's Illinois, it's New York, it's New Jersey, it's other states that have been run poor economically. And, you know, we are, what, the beginning of May? So by the time we get the May numbers, which are going to be released in June, May is going to look worse than April. And it'll probably not be until we get the July numbers, which will be for June, and maybe by the time we get to August, when we'll probably hit the bottom and the numbers will start to look better. But that raises the question, are we in a recession or more like a depression? And I think, Chris, you had a gentleman on the show, Dave Rosenberg, very prescient economist and strategist, and he thinks we have to treat this more like a depression, which is what I think it is.
The reason why I've been saying that this is actually going to be a form of depression is because a recession is a haircut to GDP, and we get through it. A depression is something different. A depression is a shock that creates scars that linger for years. And a depression is different than a recession because a depression invokes a secular change in people's behavior, how they approach savings, how they approach spending, how they approach indebtedness, how they approach, in this particular case, where we're going to work, how we're going to travel. And I think that in both the context of the personal sector and the business sector, it's going to be a big shift on how we treat savings.
So that was David Rosenberg talking about why we need to think about this in terms of a depression-like event, given the long-term secular change that this is going to have on consumption, on borrowing, on savings. And as many of you have probably seen, U.S. savings rate now jumping to the highest level in nearly 40 years. So Jim, let's talk about how this fits into something we've been talking about quite a bit, the alphabet-shaped recovery, VUL, or something else.
You know, I think it's going to be something else. And once again, I'm in the Rosenberg camp that this is a depression. Greg Weldon and I talked earlier in the show, is there a letter out there that kind of looks like an L and then slopes down? So if anybody is familiar with a foreign language that has an alphabet that looks like that, please send us the symbol. If you look what the government did, the government blew a vast hole in the economy. Chris, and I think it's going to take years to come back. You just can't do what the government did. I mean, when you shut down factories, you shut down restaurants, you quarantine people to their homes, when you shut down everything from car dealerships to other kinds of businesses, you can't expect this to bounce back. Now, what the government was trying to do with the PPP plan, which is payroll protection plan, was give companies money to keep their workers on the payroll so that when the economy does bounce back, we can bounce back quicker because these people aren't out of work permanently and they're now on unemployment. So that was the whole purpose of the PPP plan, was hopefully to get more of a V-shaped recovery coming back out of this. But Chris, this is looking more like a depression than a recession because I just don't think many of those businesses are coming back. Let's look at retail. What if we get a second reoccurrence this fall when the flu season begins at the end of September? Are you going to want to go, for example, at Christmas, walk into a large shopping mall or wearing a mask or gloves? I just don't think that's going to happen. Are ladies going to want to walk up to the makeup bar at Nordstrom's without a mask and have another individual applying makeup or whatever they do at that counter? I just don't see that happening. Think about restaurants, how they're going to have to be redone. You're not going to have tables right next to each other. There's going to have to be social distancing practiced in restaurants. And as Greg and I were talking earlier in the show, one of the things about restaurants is the weekend program of customers going out to dinner on the weekend, they count on that to make money because you just don't get the traffic as much during the week. And the other thing that restaurants count on, because I used to be a busboy when I was going through college, is that turnover. You want to turn over those tables two or three times in an evening to make money. Well, what happens if you can only put or fit in 50% of your customers? What are bars going to be like? There was a great article in the Wall Street Journal on Wednesday of what is going to happen to a lot of these gym memberships. And if you're trying to get exercise equipment at home, good luck trying to get, they're actually rationing dumbbells or exercise bands. A friend of mine is one of the original founders of one of the nation's largest exercise equipment companies. All their home gyms are completely sold out. And a lot of it is manufactured in parts in China, then brought here to California and assembled. You know, they're not going to have anything until June. What about large retailers? How many malls are going to go under? Think about hotels and airlines. How many people are going to feel good about if we open up the economy, you're going to be hopping on a jet and flying all over the world? I just don't think you're going to see a lot of that. Last weekend, I went to one of the strip malls that we have here locally. First thing was the AMC Theater closed. Bankrupt. A lot of the small retail shops, from jewelry stores to small clothing stores, all closed. I met with the owner of a Legree studio because I'm thinking of getting a Legree machine. She was explaining the protocol that she goes through in her gym. All the machines are sanitized with sanitation wipes, all the precautions she's taken, but she's closed down. And she has to pay a leasing agreement on the machines that she has. So, you know, she's worried about her customers. Now, she's been leasing out some of her machines to customers that they can use at home. But she's wondering, you know, what's going to happen to her business? And I think you're going to see a lot of social behavior that's going to change. Like I said, going out to eat or how we shop or going out to gyms or travel. All of that is going to change. And it was really quite something. I mean, I hadn't been to, you know, other than Costco, I hadn't been to a major strip mall in probably 6-7 weeks. And it was just amazing looking at it. It was just decimated. Instead of the parking lot full of cars, I mean, you could park almost anywhere. The only place that there were any cars was at the grocery store.
Yeah, as we've been discussing on our show with especially Howard Davidowitz and some others, America is the most overstored place on the planet. When you think about how much square footage, adding up all the malls and all the different stores per capita, we have overbuilt massively. And a lot of that goes back again to what we saw during the housing bubble in the mid-2000s with all this wealth creation from people, you know, using their house as a piggy banks. There was a ton of retail spending, massive overbuilding, and now we're really starting to feel the effects of that on the downside.
Yeah, and I can remember talking to Howard, and this was, what, 2 or 3 years ago before COVID, and he said basically about 50% of the mall space will disappear, and I believe that's true. Now, on the positive side of this, Chris, is we're going to see in a capitalistic society this creative destruction where the economy is going to be resized and reshaped. Something I talked about back in 2014, the big are going to get bigger in my Land of the Giants story, where you have basically 1,400 corporations that account for over 50% of the world's GDP. And what have you seen? You've seen a lot of these companies buy other companies. There's fewer aircraft makers. There's fewer car makers. There's fewer of everything. And a lot of these big companies are simply just buying their competitors. And it's one of the reasons Warren Buffett likes companies that have a moat or a protective moat. Basically, what Warren Buffett likes is oligopolies. These are companies that control and dominate and are price leaders in their field. The other thing you're going to see, in fact, the day we're doing this show, the government just ordered, I think it was like 60 million masks that come from China. They said, we're not going to take them because they've been defective. So you're going to see a lot of reshoring. You're going to see businesses come back. I'm not sure they're going to come back. All of them are going to come back to the U.S. You may see Mexico. A lot of companies go to Mexico for the labor cost. And also, you're going to see this reordering of the supply chain. Does it make sense, as we've talked on previous programs, to have 85% of your drugs or 90% of your vaccines come from China? You're also going to see an acceleration in automation. A great article in the Financial Times and also in the Wall Street Journal talking about companies that are thinking of coming back are going to be using more automation in the factories they bring back. So you're going to see, once again, the economy resized and reshaped as a result of this.
History suggests that unravelings always eventually lead into fourth turnings, and that's the era we're in. We think this fourth turning started with the GFC in 2008, 2009, and that this turning will last all the way until the year 2030. So we expect that the 2020s, which is ahead of us, is going to be a particularly climactic or pivotal point in this fourth turning in this crisis era, and that we will engage in a huge amount of creative destruction of public institutions.
So that was Neil Howe in our recent interview with him on FS Insider to discuss his book, The Fourth Turning, which was written in late 1996, and a number of predictions they made, one of which is that we would see problems start to hit around the mid-2000s and that that would lead to a generational change in behavior, as we're discussing today, going for about 20 years. So that brings us up to 2030. So Jim, Neil Howe talking about how he expects us to be in this period of time where we see a massive reorientation of a lot of the different things that we've grown accustomed to over past decades to be changing pretty dramatically for another 10 years.
Yeah, because, I mean, COVID-19 is one of those seminal events that is going to change people's behavior. And we're going to even talk about where this is leading with technology, what this means for investments. And as you mentioned, Chris, savings rates are back to where they were in the 1970s. I think you're also going to see people shop smarter, but shop less, because there's just simply too much debt out there, something that Greg Weldon and I talked about earlier in the show. But I also think that you're going to see people travel less. Staycations are going to be the new thing. And all of this massive amount of debt, which we'll get to shortly, is going to limit people's ability to spend, because the debt levels have been going up, and we were heading into trouble with consumer debt levels prior to COVID-19, this is just accelerating that. The other event I think you're going to see come out of this, Chris, is a migration change that people are going to move to less populous centers in places that are less expensive. Places like California, you know, most people can't afford to buy a home here. You have townhomes here selling for the price of mansions elsewhere. So I think you're going to see a migration change. And this is also going to reshape spending patterns, just like the Great Depression. I remember my mother growing up, she would cut coupons out of the newspaper for groceries or special events. And she did that, Chris, to the day she died. That was a behavior she learned from her mother during the Great Depression, and it stayed with her the rest of her life. So I think a lot of the behavioral changes we're going to see right now are going to stay with us. As Neil Howe talked about, it's going to reshape not only the country, but reshape a whole generation.
And Jim, on top of that, you know, you recently wrote a really interesting article. We'll have a link out to that where this show is located on Financial Sense, talking about the end of money. It's an end of money series that you've been writing, getting lots of great feedback on it. But when we think about how this equates to government spending, of course, we're seeing checks issued. We're seeing trillions of dollars. I think Chris Paplava said in our Smart Macro last week that if you add everything that's been done now with the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government and what has been earmarked for future stimulus, it amounts to $12 to $13 trillion in dollars. That's a lot of money. And so you recently wrote about the mountain of debt that we're facing. Give us some of your thoughts on just how much debt we're looking at.
By the end of the year, well, first of all, the budget deficit is going to be closer to $4 trillion this year. It was already at $1 trillion before COVID-19. But let me just give you a reason why we're going to hit $4 trillion. The national debt will be at $28 trillion next year. It'll be over $30 trillion. And in my article, I said, let's just take a look at fiscal stimulus. CARES Act was $2.2 trillion. The supplemental aid to small business was $484 billion. And you take a look at the Stimulus 3, which is in the works. They're working on this. They're talking about suspension of payroll taxes for business and employers, and then sending everybody a check for $2,000 a month, like this universal income plan under a certain level of income. That could be, God knows, that could be a half a trillion to $1 trillion. You've got an infrastructure bill of $2 trillion that the president is working on, hoping to get it through Congress. You've got extended unemployment benefits to 39 weeks, plus an additional $600 a week. You've got waivers of IRA penalties to get at your money, and $4 trillion in loan guarantees. The Fed has $8.5 trillion of direct loan assistance. Now, that's just fiscal policy. Now, let's talk about what's going on at the Fed level. Because who's paying for all this? Where's the money coming from? The government is issuing a lot of debt. And to give you an example, in March of 2009, the Fed launched QE1 for $1.7 trillion over a 14-month period. Then they announced QE2, $600 billion. That was 9 months. And then we announced QE3. That was $1.6 trillion over 16 months. QE4, $2 trillion in just 2 months. I'm not going to read everything. I would encourage you to go to our site and read the article. But basically, the Fed is backstopping any kind of asset that's out there around the globe. Everything from U.S. debt, agency debt, commercial paper, money market funds, muni bonds, foreign central banks, primary government dealers, student loans, car loans, or any other asset-backed security. And this is just an unprecedented level. And Chris, we haven't even gotten to the bailout of the states, which many states are asking. You know, New York wants $4 billion. California wants several billion. Illinois wants several billion. New Jersey. A number of states are going to be at the trough asking for money because they've been poorly managed and they want to get bailed out. So this is just the beginning of this debt pyramid. And then also, there are going to be not just states, but there's going to be cities. What do you tell a city like New York or Chicago or Los Angeles or San Francisco? What do you tell those cities if you're bailing out the state or you're bailing out corporations? And can you blame them? You know, Governor Cuomo, he says, hey, you're bailing out airlines and you're bailing out other industries. Why aren't you bailing us out? So they're working on that. The government impact on the economy is we're seeing government intervention at all levels we've never seen before. You'd have to probably go back to the New Deal and the Great Depression to see the kind of events that we're seeing today. And it's really the rise of statism. You've got massive expansion of power from bailouts, stimulus packages, healthcare, money printing, intervention, where basically they're using a regulatory environment designed to favor big companies and rid competition, which is what we're seeing today, is the rise of oligopolies. Basically, the big are going to get bigger because they're buying out their competition. The other thing is the rise or symbiosis between the surveillance state from big government and big tech, which is leading to censorship and surveillance of individuals, giving up a lot of our privacy. Wall Street Journal had a great article going back to work, how some companies are going to be installing thermal cameras in their workspace so they can measure your temperature, keep track of where you're going, which we're doing now in California, is we're tracking where people are going. We've seen all kinds of stories where the government is overstepping its bounds, trampling constitutional liberties. And it's just, once again, government is the least prepared to run an economy and interfere with supply and demand characteristics that run a capitalistic society.
Jim, another thing that we've been discussing on the program is just the degree to which the government has been prepared for this. And I think we'd all agree that this was a shock, right? Just in terms of even having the amount of protective equipment on hand by medical professionals. What are your thoughts in just terms of some of the models and some of these bigger things that a lot of people are grappling with and discussing regularly in the media today?
Well, first of all, the models have all been wrong by a factor of 10. Initially, they were talking about 2 million deaths in the U.S. The guy that came out with the model has his own moral issues and had to resign in England. You've got the WHO, when they in January said this wasn't spreadable, then they changed their mind. They said it was contagious. We had the government in the daily press briefing saying that masks were not necessary. Then about a month later, they flip-flopped and they said, no, masks are necessary. Then you had the lockdown, which was supposed to be the response. And a lot of states and countries were criticized that didn't go through lockdowns, like Sweden. And then you have the WHO, which endorses Sweden's lockdown-free approach to tackling coronavirus, which now they're reversing there. And then you just have some of these mandates that are coming by government. Not only do they trample freedoms, but none of them make sense. I mean, the Michigan governor that, you know, told Home Depot, you can't sell paint, close down your paint department, flooring, your garden shop, grocery stores couldn't sell seeds. You could go on a body of water like Lake Michigan in a kayak, in a canoe, but not a boat. Or here in San Diego, we couldn't go sailing in the bay. I don't know how you're going to spread corona in a sailboat or a powerboat on the bay. I guess if you had other people on your boat, maybe that might be it. Or opening up the beaches where you can surf and walk, but you can't lay down in the sun. Or, you know, you had the case this week in Texas of the beauty salon operator that had to go before a judge and said, you don't have the right to, the governor doesn't have the right to shut me down. But the judge said, I do. Unless you want to admit to me you're selfish. Well, she ended up going to jail. So some of this stuff, Chris, is, you know, one day they're telling you to do one thing, and then we find out another day, no, you shouldn't be doing that. You should be doing this. I mean, it changes constantly. Now, part of it is a lot of this was unknown at the beginning. So they were going with models. Models are only as good as the inputs that go into those models. But the big factor here, and this goes back to statism, is the intervention of the government. And as we can see, the flip-flops and the number of mistakes that have been made by government through this whole process.
I went to the beach yesterday, and it was interesting because you are allowed to go to the beach now, thankfully, here. They opened the beaches up after flip-flopping. And there was a lifeguard that was going around, and if you were standing, he would tell you, sorry, you can't be standing. You have to be moving. So it's funny because everyone is kind of walking around in circles or just sort of mulling around a little bit, walking back and forth, you know, but everyone was doing their best just not to stand still, because if you stand still, then you're breaking the rules. So it's just kind of the ridiculousness of the situation, like you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, let's suppose you wanted to lay out and get a suntan or just lay out and enjoy, and you were 6, 8, 10 feet away from somebody else, you're still practicing social distancing. So the fact you can't stand and have to be constantly moving, this is the kind of idiotic advice that we're being given. Once again, governments aren't prepared to make the best decisions, and many times they're making decisions ad hoc, flippantly, without any thought given to the consequences of their decisions. And one of them is to shut down the entire economy.
And as we all know, I mean, a centralized system cannot appreciate the full range of complexities that exist in an economy. You just cannot run an economy from top down. Neither can you dictate to what people can do in every single instance, because as we were pointing out, a lot of these rules make no sense at all. I mean, like you're saying, you can't lay down on the beach, even if you're social distancing, you still can't lay down. You have to be moving. So in that case, well, you could be moving and walking next to someone, but that's still okay. So it's just, that's the thing, is the government cannot run the economy, nor can it appreciate the full range of complexities that exist in human interaction. And that's what we're dealing with today. Jim, let's talk about some of the investment implications here. I know you've got a number of things that you want to get to. So share with our audience some of the things that you're looking at and telling others.
Well, I mean, Chris, if you look at investment advisory business, if you look at investment management, you give somebody your goals, your age, and they come up with a model. And that model is going to be so much in stocks, large caps, small caps, so much in bonds, international, domestic, corporate, whatever it is. And then it's kind of like set and forget. That works well when you're in a stable environment or you're in an upward trend of a recovery, as we were with 2000, coming out of 2008 and 2009 when the economy recovered. But notice that throughout this recovery, not only did we get 7 years of zero interest rates, but we also got stimulus. Remember what Trump did in coming in, putting into play in 2018, a multi-trillion dollar stimulus package. And then the Fed coming in, cutting interest rates. So set and forget, I just don't think it's going to work in the next few years. A lot of people, I've been hearing stories, we've been taking on new clients where people literally lost millions of dollars. So I think, you know, active management, once considered dead, is back in favor. And also, some of the ETFs, as Greg Weldon and I were talking about, some of these commodity ETFs, that most of the time the commodity market is operating in contango, which means that every month those contracts are rolled over at a higher price versus backwardation, where each month is a lower price. So you had the mishap that we had last month with USO blowing up with negative interest rates. And Chris, I think that could happen again because they're taking on more money And people think they don't understand how the commodities markets work and the futures market works. And they're getting themselves locked in these investments, these commodity ETFs. I don't care if it's USO or any kind of commodity ETF. It just doesn't operate to the advantage in favor of the retail investor. The people that benefit from this are mainly the bankers. And at some point in time, we're going to reach a point, the government and the Fed are trying to bring the dollar down. Because the dollar, a rising dollar hurts emerging markets, a rising dollar hurts international profits of most of our international companies. And eventually, they're going to inflate enough where the dollar is going to fall. We're going to end up devaluing, as I wrote in my first installment of The End of Money. And I think eventually you're going to see the bond vigilantes come back. And it's one reason why we prefer buying individual bonds. We know the maturities. We can keep them where we want. And we have more control. I don't have to be dependent on a individual investor panicking, forcing a bond fund manager to sell good bonds or sell them at discounted prices, because that's how we pick up our bonds. We love it when there's a bond panic, because we can go in and pick up these bonds for a song and get, you know, thinking of one bond we bought recently, it had a coupon rate of less than 2%, but because we bought it at a steep discount in a fire sale, we were able to pick up a yield of 4%, plus we're going to have capital gains when the bond matures. The other thing I think that's going to do well in this kind of market going forward, Chris, is technology, healthcare, and I think gold, and eventually oil. That may sound strange saying that today, but that's going to be an entirely separate show. I think cash is going to remain at zero. Remember, they kept it at zero in the last recession. The Fed kept interest rates at zero for 7 years. Because of the financial crisis, they're likely to keep it there for longer. It's one of the reasons several years ago, coming out of the financial crisis, we started a new service. Several of our clients ran their own companies and they had large amounts of corporate cash that was getting zero. And obviously, there's a limitation in terms of keeping it at a bank in terms of what is covered. So we now have a cash management system that we manage for corporations. If you keep more than $1 million or more, where we can get you better returns, you can get it in a bank or T-bills or a money market fund. But also, Chris, following this, I think the Fed's going to have to use financial repression, because at the end of the year, we should be with a deficit around $4 trillion this year. The national debt should be somewhere around $28 trillion next year if we keep up with the stimulus. And we're still trying to work our way out of this depression. We could be over $30 trillion. And who knows, by the time this is done, we could be at $40 trillion. They're going to have to keep interest rates at zero. The one good thing about where the government is now, and that's why they're encouraging people, if you notice that the government is changing the maturities on its bond auctions to longer maturities, because they're taking advantage of historically low interest rates. Interest rates have ticked up here just a little bit recently, but you still have the 10-year note at roughly 0.6%, a little over 60 basis points. You've got the 30-year bond at 1.3%. Retirees can't survive on 0.6%. Pension funds can't survive at 0.6%. Insurance companies can't survive at 0.6%. So that's why eventually, you know, we like the control we get with an individual bond, because you've got money moving into bond funds, you have money moving out of bond funds, depending on the latest news stories, what's happening. And eventually, you're not going to be able to keep printing money, and not producing stuff without eventually this leading to inflation down the road. So financial repression is going to be with us, Chris, in my opinion, for many, many years to come.
So getting income in today's environment is difficult, but it can be done. And that's what we do here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, not just for large corporations, but for investors and retirees of all stripes. So with that said, Jim, what is the best way to get a hold of Financial Sense Wealth Management to speak with our advisors and staff?
They can give us a toll-free call at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. 1-800-486-3939. And I would invite you to go to our website and read my latest installment, Mountains of Debt. It's part of an ebook that I'm going to be coming out. This is chapter 4. I think I'm going to be up to about 10 or 12 chapters by the time this is all finished. But read Mountains of Debt and go back if you can. Read the original installment, which was called End of Money, which is the name of my new upcoming ebook. But we're going to release this by chapters, and I invite you to read it. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, stay safe and have a pleasant weekend.
As always, if you have any feedback for us on what we discussed today, go to financialsense.com and hit contact us. Also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about Financial Sense News Hour, the wide range of guests and topics that we discuss to keep you ahead of the trends and ahead of the herd at all times and know what's really going on with the financial markets and the economy. Don't forget about our premium podcast as well that airs 3 days during the week, where we interview top investment strategists, book authors, and industry experts from around the world. People like Martin Armstrong, David Rosenberg, Russell Napier, Gary Schilling, Jim Bianco, Felix Zuloff, and a long list of other names. If you want to sign up for that, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.